This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings to the May episode listeners. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson, and not joining me in the studio today are staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
And production editor Neil McKim.
Hello.
Instead, we are all recording from our own homes while we socially distance ourselves from each other. So apologies if our audio isn't quite up to its usual quality. However, I do assure you that we will be delivering the same quality content that we always do.
Of course.
The pandemic is no reason to give up on stargazing, however. Though you may be unable to travel to a dark sky site, there are still plenty of things that you can see from your back garden, or even from the comfort of your own armchair. You can visit www.skyatnightmagazine.com to read our full list of all the ways that you can do astronomy from isolation. But for now, here are a few of our favourite activities.
Learn your way around the night sky by finding the brightest constellations and then using an app or guide to begin navigating around.
One of the things I've been enjoying is just grabbing a pair of binoculars and standing in the garden and looking up at, Venus at the moment, but also the moon. The moon's great, even through a pair of modest binoculars, and you can see lots of lunar features and spot its changing faces night after night. And actually, we've got some good observing guides on the website. So if you go to skyatnightmagazine.com/the-moon, there's lots of content on there to help you get started.
And if you're feeling artistic, you can always grab a pencil and paper when you're looking at the moon and try making your own lunar sketches. This is a great way to learn all of the features and really get a look at close up at the detail that you might otherwise miss. It's also because we can all see the moon from our own gardens. It's a great way to connect with family and friends. Even though you're far away, you all see the same moon. So why not all go out, draw it at the same time, and then share your efforts afterwards, and so you can be together even though you're far apart.
And why not become a citizen scientist and take part in an online astronomy project? You can visit science.nasa.gov/citizen science for a list of all NASA's latest projects. These include helping to explore backyard worlds, or perhaps you could upload images to help with JunoCam.
Yeah, that's a good one for anyone who's currently in isolation or lockdown and doesn't have a back garden. That's a good thing that you can kind of do. And another thing is you can actually download data from space missions, and you can use software such as like the free software GIMP or Photoshop if you have it, and you can actually process these images. So you're taking data from space missions like Juno or some of the other NASA planetary missions or the Hubble Space Telescope and actually processing them yourself. And you can find out more about that if you visit our website, and in the search bar at the top of the page, just start searching process. I found that that brings up all our guides to processing space images.
And of course, there's all the latest episodes of the Sky at Night TV show on iPlayer. They also have a wealth of archive footage that's available on there with Patrick Moore talking to Neil Armstrong, as well as all kinds of other things, activities that you can do from your own back garden or even out of a window. So have a look on there, and hopefully you should find lots that you can get up to, even if you can't get away to your favourite observing site. But now, back to this month's issue, that's the May issue. This episode of the podcast should be coming out on around the 24th of April. On that date in 1990, a very important spacecraft made its way into orbit. You might have heard of it. It's called the Hubble Space Telescope. So today, 30 years on, we're going to take a look back at what this remarkable observatory has been up to.
So firstly, it's worth mentioning that the Hubble Space Telescope is named after Edwin Hubble, a famous US astronomer who changed the way astronomers looked at the universe. Before Hubble, it was widely believed that the observable universe consisted of one galaxy, our Milky Way. But by studying variable stars in faint nebulae, Hubble proved that these galaxies were too distant to be part of our galaxy. In 1929, he observed that the velocity of such galaxies was proportional to their distance from Earth, the first evidence for the universe's expansion. The idea of putting a telescope in Earth's atmosphere was first suggested by German scientist Hermann Oberth in the 1920s. Basically, the idea was to get a scope into a position above the distortion of the atmosphere, far above the clouds and light pollution, to give an unobstructed view of the universe beyond. In the 40s, the American physicist Lyman Spitzer promoted the idea further, and it gathered momentum, being taken up by NASA in the late 60s with the idea of launching a large space telescope, as it was then known. In all, dozens of contractors, a handful of universities, and several NASA centers spanning 21 states and 12 other countries helped to make the space telescope a reality. But although funding was approved in the 70s, constraints overshadowed the space telescope's development. Hubble was supposed to carry 7 instruments, but due to cost-cutting, NASA reduced this to 4. But fortunately, ESA, the European Space Agency, stepped in with a 5th, while over in Britain, British Aerospace contributed solar arrays built in Bristol. The California-based aerospace giant Lockheed was chosen to assemble the spacecraft, and it was no small task, as the space telescope was 13 meters long and was the equivalent weight of 2 full-grown elephants. Among its instruments was its wide-field and planetary camera, which was replaced in 1993 and again in 2009. This had dual cameras spanning from far ultraviolet to near infrared wavelengths. The WFPC, as it was known, was designed to make panoramic observations of hundreds of distant galaxies and high-resolution imaging of planets in our solar system. Although Hubble was supposed to be transported into orbit on a space shuttle in 1983, it was put back due to issues with its mirror until 1986. The original plan of installing a 3-metre mirror had also changed because of budget constraints to 2.4 metres. Unfortunately, the Challenger space shuttle disaster in 1986 put it back another 4 years until 1990, but this gave time to improve the solar panels and make other adjustments. Finally, on the 24th of April 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched on board the Space Shuttle Discovery. It entered a geocentric orbit 550 kilometres above Earth, travelling at a speed of 2,800 kilometres an hour and orbiting every 97 minutes. And back on Earth, scientists were ready for when Hubble's data streamed in. At NASA's Goddard Space Flight Centre, a control station could directly communicate with Hubble via an orbiting network of tracking and data relay satellites. And on the Maryland campus of the Johns Hopkins University, a dedicated space telescope science institute could run day-to-day operations, selecting targets with plans to make 30,000 observations every year. To get it into space, the project cost an eye-watering total of $4.7 billion, but arguably Hubble's launch marked the most significant advancement in astronomy since Galileo's time.
You kind of forget that this has been in, you said that it was being in plan since about the 1930s, the 1940s.
Yeah.
That's 20 years before Sputnik went up. So they were planning this before they even really knew how to get into space. That just blows my mind.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear that it really kind of took off within NASA around the 60s, because you can just sense what was happening at NASA in the 1960s and the space race and the Cold War and Kennedy's speech, and they were obviously just coming up with so many ideas of all these different things that they can now do, you know, since the Soviets had proven that you could indeed launch satellites and even human beings into space.
It was that sort of philosophy of, well, if we can put a person on the moon, I guess anything's possible.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the things I've been looking at is the problems that started after they'd launched Hubble, because there were issues with the optics. Just after the launch of Hubble, the first images revealed this aberration in the telescope's primary mirror that was affecting the clarity of the images. And ultimately, I suppose it was a bit of a PR disaster, wasn't it? You know, they'd been touting this brand new space telescope that was going to change the way we looked at the universe, and you know, its first images were faulty, and it was something that they were going to have to fix. And they diagnosed the problem as the mirror being too flat, out by about 1/50th of the thickness of a human hair, and it just being that
on something that was 2.5 meters wide or something.
Just that much too flat, that rather than collecting 70% of starlight to the focal point, it could only collect 10-15%. Because I guess if you think about a lens, that's what it's doing, isn't it? It's curved and it's focusing light to a focal point. So just even being out by that much was completely ruining what they could see. It's interesting to note, though, between 1990 and 1993, they did actually process some Hubble images, and they were able to use computer software to correct the optics, but they couldn't really use that for fainter, more distant objects, so the problem had to be solved at the source. And there's a great story of a guy called James Crocker, who was an optical engineer. He was working at NASA at the time, and he travelled to Munich to meet with the European Space Agency because they were going to discuss potential solutions to the problem. And when I was reading this, I thought this was a bit strange, but apparently in the United States at the time, they didn't have adjustable, retractable shower heads, because Crocker was in his hotel room and he was looking up at the shower and noticing how it could be retracted and adjusted. And that was his eureka moment. That's when he came up with the idea that you could create corrective optics that could be retracted into position and correct the flaw in Hubble's optics. So this was one of the things this is basically what they came up with. Luckily, one of the things about Hubble was that it was designed to be able to have regular servicing to upgrade it. So they knew that they'd be able to actually put human beings up there to fix it. And they did this throughout Hubble's life, really, well up until 2009, via the space shuttle. So astronauts would load into the space shuttle, they'd go up into Earth orbit, and then the space shuttle's robotic arm would grab Hubble, they'd load it into the payload bay, and they would perform the upgrade, and then afterwards they would have about 3 or 5 days of spacewalks to check everything over and make sure everything power was still working. I mean, it's incredible, and think about it, isn't it, that that they were able to do that?
Yeah, it's... I remember reading about Mike Massimino, who was one of the astronauts that became known as the Hubble guy, because he went up and did... I think he did 3 repair missions, it might have been just 2. And it's just that's one of those things. It's like, well, what did you do? Well, I fixed Hubble.
Yeah, there's a great photo of Mike Massimino, and he's during one of the servicing missions. I think it might be the last servicing mission, and he's peering through. He's outside the shuttle, and he's peering in through a window. And the astronaut Megan MacArthur is on the inside looking at the camera, and Mike Massimino is like behind her outside peering through the window. It's cool. It's a great image.
That's cute.
You'll be able to find it on NASA's website if you just do a quick Google. So the first servicing mission was carried out by the space shuttle via the space shuttle Endeavour, which was launched in December 1993. And then they installed the Wide Field and Planetary Camera 2. And this is a bit of a mouthful, the Corrective Optics Space Telescope Axial Replacement, which has the nice acronym COSTAR. And these two devices corrected all the optics and instruments. This classic NASA acronyms, isn't it?
I swear they come up with a word and then work out how they're going to shoehorn something into it afterwards.
Yeah.
Back to those.
But the that first servicing mission took 11 months of training. The astronauts spent over 230 hours in a water tank practicing with over 150 tools to get the procedure right before they launched. And then when they were in space, it took 7 astronauts 10 days and 5 spacewalks to fit the optics and check everything over and make sure it was okay. And during the mission, they also replaced the solar arrays, 4 gyroscopes, 2 magnetometers and other electrical components. And they also upgraded the onboard computers to help keep the telescope running. And I think really when you look back at that first servicing mission, that's the thing to focus on, because a lot of people that I've spoken to had this kind of cynical attitude to Hubble. I can't believe they launched that telescope and, you know, it cost so much money and they didn't even get it right. I mean, mistakes happen, but I think if you focus on the fact they were able to put it right, that shows the intelligence and the ability.
It's like we were talking about in the last episode about Apollo 13. It's sometimes accident happen, but it's just as much a remarkable achievement being able to say, okay, that happened, but we fixed it. And we made sure it worked.
Exactly. They had the foresight to work out how to do it, but also the ability to actually do that, to actually send astronauts up to actually fix it. I mean, that's incredible when you think about it.
It's one of the big shames about the fact that because the space shuttle program had its issues, but the fact that you now can't make these kinds of surfacing missions anymore. People aren't even attempting to make them anymore. I think is a shame. And I hope that one day in the future, maybe when Orion, which is NASA's new human spaceflight module, comes online, maybe they'll start doing these kind of serviceable, upgradable missions again.
Yeah. There were 5 servicing missions between 1993 and 2009. The last servicing mission was carried out via the Atlantis space shuttle in May 2009. It replaced the primary data handling unit and repaired other instruments, upgraded the wide field camera to wide field camera 3, and installed the cosmic origin spectrograph, and a soft capture mechanism was put in, which, as far as I understand it, would enable a future mission to perform a safe controlled deorbit of the Hubble Space Telescope.
They basically put a handle on it.
Yeah, rather than other satellites that burn up in the atmosphere. It would be nice to think that one day Hubble will be sitting in Kennedy Space Center where we can all go and visit it.
Hopefully. Hopefully they don't just crash it into the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
That'd be a big splash if it weighs 2 elephants equivalent.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Crashing down from orbit. Over the last 30 years, since those improvements happened, Hubble has been doing some incredible science. Pretty much every astronomical breakthrough of the last 30 years, Hubble has had its eye in there somewhere. It's one of the most productive scientific instruments ever built. Over 15,000 papers are attributed to it, which have 738,000 citations, which is a lot of citations, and it's done over 1.3 million observations. It's an incredible machine. Obviously, I can't go over every single scientific discovery it's ever done, because we'll be here all week, but there are a couple which really do stand out. So one of the biggest things that it did was actually one of the things it got sent up to do in the first place, which was measure how fast the universe was expanding. And it did this by very, very accurately measuring how far away supernovas were in distant galaxies. And by looking at that, it could tell how far away those galaxies were and how fast they were moving away from us here in the Milky Way. And that helped them measure something called the Hubble constant, which is a measure of how fast the universe is expanding. It's named after Hubble, the person, not Hubble, the telescope, even though Hubble measured it. The telescope measured it. Just to make matters really confusing.
Was that done with, sorry to interrupt this, but was that done with those type 1A supernovas? I just love hearing about those. Go tell us what the type 1A supernovas is.
So type 1A supernovas are what are known as standard candles. They explode, at least people are very confident that they explode with the same brightness every time. Because the way that they explode is you have two stars next to each other, one which is quite small and dense, the other one which is usually a red giant, which is very diffuse but got lots of mass. The white star steals the gas from around the red giant until it gets to a critical mass, and it forms a black, it goes supernova. And that supernova, because it happens at a very specific mass, always has the same brightness. And if you know exactly how bright something is, and you know how bright it appears, you can compare those two and work out how far away something is. So that's one of the ways they measure distances in the universe. And as they did this for a whole bunch of galaxies, they used it to measure the expansion of the galaxy, the universe, and realized that not only was the expansion of the galaxy not slowing down or at an even speed, it was actually speeding up. Something was driving the galaxy further apart the further away it got. If you just think about gravity, that doesn't make a lot of sense. The further apart things are, the less they're pulling on each other, so surely that expansion should slow down. But that wasn't happening. So astronomers invented, for want of a better term, this concept of dark energy, which is something that is kind of, as things get further apart, it drives them further away. And people have been spending the last 30 years trying to work out whether dark energy even exists, whether there's some other explanation for the expansion of the universe, and if dark energy does exist, what is it and can we see it? So that's one of the biggest, big things that Hubble's come across. Another thing that Hubble looked into was the fact that there are supermassive black holes in the heart of every single galaxy. Before Hubble, people assumed that there were black holes at the center of galaxies, but they'd never actually seen them, and they didn't know how widespread they were if they did actually exist. And one of the things that Hubble could do was it had such high resolution, it could look in the heart of a galaxy and see how fast it was rotating. And if the stars were rotating really fast, but there didn't appear to be anything in the middle, then you can say, oh, there must be something really massive in the center that's stopping those stars from flying away. And that would be a supermassive black hole. And Hubble did a census of loads and loads of galaxies and discovered that pretty much every single massive galaxy, at least everyone like our Milky Way, has one of these supermassive black holes at its center. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that the Event Horizon Telescope actually managed to take a picture of one of these black holes, or rather take a picture of its shadow. So Hubble was really managing to like look into the literal dark and find these things, which I think is quite incredible. Another place where Hubble has managed to look where other telescopes can't is into stellar nurseries. Stellar nurseries are usually incredibly dusty regions, meaning if you're looking in visible light, all you're going to see is the dust. You're not going to see the stars being born inside of it. But Hubble has really excellent infrared and ultraviolet cameras on board. The infrared can look through the dust, because infrared light does travel through the dust. And it showed that inside these stellar nurseries, rather than being a nice, calm environment, which nursery might suggest, they were in fact incredibly violent places filled with enormously hot objects, throwing out shock fronts and violent force all over the place. Because Hubble has been going for so long, this 30 years, it's been able to watch these nurseries as they grow and evolve over that 30-year baseline, which is when you think about most stars, you think, oh, but they live for billions and billions, sometimes even trillions of years. The fact that you can see these changes happening over 30 years, I think, is actually quite incredible.
Yeah, it is mad, isn't it? Like, you wouldn't have thought that there would have been that much difference in a star's life over the period of 30 years. That's like the blink of an eye in a kind of stellar life.
I mean, it's not massive changes, but the fact that you can see anything at all is incredible. Finally, one discovery that Hubble is really starting to make a difference in now is something we'd never discovered it before Hubble had launched, and that was exoplanets. People had always suspected that, well, if there's planets around this star, there must be planets around other stars. But it wasn't until the early 1990s that people actually first discovered one around a sun-like star and saw one. And Hubble, because of its unique set of instruments that it has, is really good at finding water on exoplanets in the atmospheres. Partly that's because it's a space telescope. It's above the Earth's atmosphere. If you're trying to look for water in another atmosphere from Earth, all you're going to see is the water in our own atmosphere, which there is quite a lot of. So it blocks out the view. So those are my top hits of what Hubble has discovered. There are, of course, hundreds of others, and you can read more about some of them in the May issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, as well as the rest of what Hubble has got up to and its history for the last 30 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just thinking about some of Hubble's biggest highlights, I always think it's interesting to see how much it discovered and observed within our own solar system, because when you think of Hubble, you think of those amazing images of galaxy and nebulae, but it did actually observe planets and moons in our own solar system. So it's observed Jupiter's Great Red Spot and observed fragments of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 impacting into Jupiter, produced the first ever images of Saturn's moon Titan, and detected oxygen in Jupiter's moon Europa, as well as also potential water plumes in Europa, which is really significant when you think about planned future missions to go and sample those potential plumes, which are potentially erupting below the from below the subsurface of ocean of Europa's icy crust. But it also discovered moons around Pluto and rings around Uranus. So I just always think it's really interesting to kind of remind ourselves of that, because, as I say, a lot of Hubble's successes are touted as those amazing discoveries that you've just pointed out, Ezzy.
One of the big things that Hubble has been really good about in our own solar system is actually complementing missions that are in orbit. So, for instance, if you've got something like the Juno mission, which is in orbit around Jupiter, you get an incredible view, but it's up close. You can only see a small portion of the planet at a time. Whereas Hubble can take that look from far away and see what's going on and supply a lot of context. So there's a lot of synergy going on between the Hubble Space Telescope and various observing platforms. And also, let's not forget places like Neptune and Uranus, which don't have their own missions because they're too far away. At least I should say they don't have their own missions yet. People are working to try and change that. Hubble can get a reasonably decent look at them, and Hubble's been able to track how these planets change as they go through their seasons, which no other telescope can really do, at least not to the same extent that Hubble can.
Mm. And what about also just even Hubble in popular culture? You know, I mean, probably bar the 1969 moon landing of Apollo 11, it's difficult to think of other space missions that have left such an iconic visual imprint on popular culture in terms of its amazing images and where they've appeared.
I was looking through my bookshelves the other day, and I found a fantasy book, of all things. And I looked at the cover and realised that it was a Hubble image on it. It's just, they're everywhere. You can find them on mugs, on pencils, on book covers. Get used in films. It's just these iconic images that people instantly recognize. The most famous one being probably the Pillars of Creation, which is this kind of, that was one of the first big iconic images from Hubble.
They took that one twice, didn't they? I think in the 90s, and then they retook it because it was so popular.
I think they retook it for one of the anniversaries.
Yeah, yeah.
My own favourite Hubble pop culture reference is the Pearl Jam album Binaural, which the front cover of the album it features a Hubble image of the Hourglass Nebula, and then within the liner notes there's more Hubble images. So yeah, if you're a Pearl Jam fan and we're wondering what that weird jewel ring image is on the front cover of the binaural album, that's what it is. It's a Hubble image.
That reminds me of another scientific thing that I really should mention, which was the Hubble Deep Field, which was a series of images that they took, which basically the people running Hubble decided that they were just going to point Hubble at a random patch of sky for as long as they could, really, and see what they could see in an empty-looking patch of sky. And when they processed this image, which had, you know, hours and hours of exposure time, they turned up thousands of galaxies. And it was that sort of first thing of, oh, this universe is a lot more full than we think it is. it really kind of hammered that point home. And since they've done even deeper fields, there's the Hubble Extreme Fields, which I think has over 20 days of exposure time, if memory serves. It's kind of stunning when you think about it. It's like this patch of sky that looks completely empty to most telescopes, even on Earth. And then you point Hubble at it for 20 odd days and you just see this entire wealth of galaxies in it. It's incredible.
It is.
It's extraordinary that we're able to see things that are billions of years old as well, like these galaxies, that there's actually an image of them with light that's so old.
That's the other thing. It's that really mind-blowing concept that because light takes time to travel, if you look further into the universe, you can see further back in time. And apparently in 2016, Hubble scientists were able to use the telescope to observe a galaxy as it existed 13.4 billion years ago, which when you consider the age of the universe is estimated at 13.8 billion years, that's basically, you're looking back to the early universe, to the birth of the first galaxies.
Yeah, it's stupendous.
if anyone's interested in finding out a bit more about Hubble or getting involved in the 30th anniversary celebrations on social media, the Hubble 30 hashtag is trending as we speak, and I'm sure as this podcast comes out it'll be trending even more. So on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever social media platform you use that uses hashtags, just type in Hubble 30, and there's lots of stuff from NASA and the Hubble team themselves, and they're sharing science and discoveries and images and the history of the space telescope. It's fascinating just scrolling through the hashtag feed, so do that. But while the anniversary of Hubble is obviously about looking back at all its amazing discoveries, it should also be looking forward to the future, which brings us nicely onto this episode's interview. Because I've been speaking to Dr. Eric Smith, who's NASA's program scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope, which is due to launch in 2021. The JWST is seen as a successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, continuing our observation of the universe after Hubble is retired. And I started off by asking Dr. Smith exactly how JWST will build upon Hubble's legacy.
So Hubble, as amazing as it has been over its 30-year lifetime, has told us there are some things that we would need a different facility to answer the question. So Hubble, in some sense, has set up the scientific successor questions that Webb is designed to answer. And the reason Hubble couldn't, I'll say, finish some of the investigations or complete them is because it's got a primary mirror of a given size, and its wavelength region is primarily visible. And one of the areas in particular that Hubble pointed us to was the need for a larger and infrared telescope to find some of the earliest galaxies. So Hubble enabled us to know how to build its successor.
You mentioned there about viewing some of the earliest galaxies, and that's something that James Webb Space Telescope is going to be people to enable astronomers to do. It's kind of going to almost peer back in time, isn't it?
That's right. Because of the finite speed of light, and the very vast distances of space, when we see light from these earliest galaxies, it left a long time ago. So we are seeing back in time to when the universe was young. So even though these galaxies are very distant, they're actually young when we're observing them. And their light has been redshifted by the expansion of the universe. And so it left those very young galaxies as ultraviolet and visible light. But the expansion of the universe has stretched its wavelengths into the infrared, and that's why we optimized Webb to work there.
So how far back would we actually be able to look with James Webb Space Telescope? Could we ever actually go back as far and actually see the Big Bang happening? And if not, just how close do you think we could get?
Okay, that's a great question. So with Hubble, we can look back to see the universe and the objects in it, some of the young galaxies, when the universe was about 500 million years old. We use microwave background experiments like WMAP or the Planck mission to see the cosmic microwave background, so-called surface of last scattering, which is when the universe is 300,000 years old. So in between 300,000 and 500 million, we don't know what the universe is doing. And it's that period of time we're building Webb to look and see in that span, when did those early galaxies first form? Was it at 200 million years, 300 million years? That's the question.
How do you actually go about building a space telescope that can tell you all that? It'd be really interesting to hear exactly what sort of instruments JWST is going to have and how this will enable it to observe the universe.
Well, the first thing we knew we needed to do was have this to work in the infrared. And so you know where galaxies emit most of the light, and you know how far the universe has stretched that light. So that tells you what wavelengths you want to optimize for. And that, for us, that's wavelengths from just a little bit redder than the eye can see out to about 10 to 20 microns. So that tells you your wavelength range. Now, because these objects are very faint, we know we need a bigger mirror, and you can estimate the size of the mirror you need. And once you know those two things, then the rest of the design sort of follows. The interesting thing for us is our mirror is so big that we can't fit it into a rocket when the mirror is just one piece. So we had to make a telescope that folds up. And it's that feature of Webb that makes it so interesting and its shape so iconic.
It's really interesting hearing you talking about a mirror, because lots of our readers will be amateur astronomers. And I think probably whenever a lot of people think of space telescopes, you imagine it being something a lot more kind of high-tech or sci-fi or something like that, you know, to be able to observe the early universe. But it is actually operating with a mirror, like a kind of regular, like a regular refracting or reflecting telescope.
You're exactly right. This is a reflecting telescope. Works just the same as the telescopes you buy and use here on Earth. We look a little different because we don't have a tube around Webb. Rather, we have this sun shield, which you can almost imagine it like a parasol. So it sits on the side of the observatory that faces infrared bright sources, which for us are the sun, the Earth, and the moon. And then the telescope looks out more or less parallel to that parasol. So we don't need a tube. And the tube itself would have just been some mass that would have made the launch more difficult. So we have this so-called naked mirror, and then it feeds four different science instruments, cameras, and spectrographs.
The Hubble Space Telescope orbits Earth, as we know. Where is the James Webb Space Telescope going to actually be positioned in space?
So Webb needs to be very far away from infrared sources of light or heat. And of course, Hubble being only 250 or so miles, a few 300 some kilometers above Earth, is too close to an infrared source. So we're going to position Webb about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth at the so-called L2 or second Lagrange point. These are positions in any two-body orbiting system discovered in the late 1700s by a French-Italian mathematician, Lagrange. And if you put the telescope 1.5 million kilometers away, it's far from infrared sources, so you're not blinded by this infrared light locally. And you can keep all of them, again, to one side of you. So you just need a sun shield and you don't need a tube. And so Webb will follow the Earth in its orbit around the sun. It doesn't orbit the Earth, it orbits the sun.
That far out in space, there must be a lot of sort of dangers and extremities to contend with, be it sort of temperature or micrometeorites. How can you ensure that the telescope will be safe?
Well, temperature-wise, it's much more benign to be at L2. When you orbit the Earth, you're going in and out of the Earth's shadow, and so you're exposed to the sun. You're not exposed to the sun. You're exposed to the sun, and so you experience temperature gradients because of that. When you're out at L2, your temperature is much more stable, so that's easier in some sense for us than an Earth-orbiting telescope. Now, we're not protected by the Earth's magnetic fields, and so we are a little more exposed to cosmic radiation out there. And you mentioned micrometeoroids. We more or less know and can calculate what the expected number of micrometeoroids of a given size will hit us over a lifetime. And so when we were designing Webb, we knew we had to build in enough capability early on in the mission so that by the end of the mission lifetime, we were still able to do our science. So you more or less build it a little better than you need at the start so that by the time you take into account any micrometeoroids, you're still able to do your science.
It kind of brings us on to another point, especially in relation to Hubble. One of the most incredible things about the Hubble mission, I suppose, has been those shuttle missions to repair it, you know, and to kind of correct the optics and things like that. But that's not going to be possible with JWST. Is that an issue, do you think?
It's important to remember that while everyone knows about the Hubble servicing missions, there really is only one satellite that was ever built to be serviced, and that's Hubble. All other satellites are built assuming you will never service them, and the same is the case with Webb, primarily because we're so far away, we don't have the ability to send astronauts out that far today, and we don't have a robot that could do the repairs. So we have to build in to the design of Webb redundancy, so we make sure that in the case of motors that have to deploy things, we have more than one way to address them electrically. We can back them up and redeploy kind of things. So, and this goes on for almost every other, well, for all other satellites other than Hubble. We don't build in the assumption we'll service it. We make sure that we test it a lot on the ground to verify that it works and build in redundancy so that we don't need to service it.
Okay. I mean, do you think if we were going back 30 years and launching Hubble with the technology that we have now, the launch of Hubble and the construction of Hubble would be much different?
That's a great question. I think if we still had some shuttle capability or even just ride the Falcons up there to service it, at the time, this notion of a telescope and servicing, they were intimately linked. In some sense, the shuttle and Hubble pulled each other along as they were being developed. There's always a debate whether it would have been cheaper to just build another Hubble, and that's a sort of interesting speculation. I don't know what the ultimate answer is. I think today we know our technology is advanced enough that we don't necessarily need to build in this serviceability. Rather, we can build the smarts into the device itself. And Webb is a little bit down that path. But today, you can build in even more smarts into your spacecraft. You could imagine someday even self-healing spacecraft.
Well, that would be incredible. So do you mean some sort of AI inbuilt that could recognize a default and it could actually fix itself?
You could imagine that in the software, but I'm even thinking, speculating farther out about materials that could heal themselves. In other words, recognize that they have, a micrometeoroid impact here, and I need to repair myself where that happened. It's much easier to do that on structures that aren't optics. I think self-healing optics is probably, that's a little bit farther down the road.
Is that the sort of thing that NASA is currently looking into?
I don't know of any current research programs that are specifically looking at that, but NASA does have an organization, the acronym is the NIAC, that tends to look at really far out ideas like that, just to say, is there anything really plausible in that field. And usually people they're incredibly clever. And so even though now it sounds like science fiction, someday that will be science fact.
Just to come back to JWST, you'd be interested to hear a bit more about the sort of science it's going to do. So we've mentioned that it'll look far back in time to the early universe, but what about some of the other kind of questions that are really burning in astronomy and cosmology, like exoplanets or dark matter and things like that?
Exoplanets is obviously one that people are, keenly interested in right now. And when Webb was actually started, we knew of exactly two exoplanets at that time. But now, of course, there are thousands, and we know of dozens that are actually sort of Earth-like and nearby enough that Webb will be used to look at their atmospheres using this transit spectroscopy method, where we observe when the exoplanet passes between us and the star, and we measure a spectrum of the starlight with the planet in front of, and then when the planet is not in front of, and then you can tell what's in the atmosphere of that planet if it has an atmosphere. And so we will be looking for things like water and methane and other kinds of chemicals that could indicate habitability for those exoplanets. So that's something we already know that people are proposing to do with Webb. Because it's an infrared telescope, it also is going to be used to look inside of dust clouds where stars are forming in our own galaxy, like in the Orion Nebula. Infrared light penetrates these clouds of dust that get blocked by visible light. And so we know there are going to be programs to study the births of stars in these clouds. And finally, because we can see more or less the full history of galaxy formation, we can watch the universe assemble galaxies across cosmic time, which is, you get the full family picture from the baby pictures to the grandparent pictures then.
What about those two other questions and dark matter and dark energy? Is JWST going to be able to contribute anything to those fields?
In the case of dark energy, people will probably be using, or they'll propose to use Webb to help us get better measure of the Hubble constant, which would help to resolve. Right now, there's a controversy between the age of the universe or the Hubble constant measured through microwave background and through the kind of supernova studies. And so people will use Webb to help answer or address that discrepancy right now. And in the case of dark matter, we'll again be looking at many galaxies across cosmic time and, looking at their rotation curves to see how much dark matter they would contain. And does that tell us anything different from what we know from just doing visible light studies?
It's interesting thinking back on the Hubble mission, because I think one of the most iconic aspects of the mission has been the incredible images. And I think that's definitely something people are looking forward to with JWST. With JWST, will we get the same amazing images of nebulae and galaxies and things like that that we had with Hubble?
Yes, we designed JWST to be diffraction limited at 2 microns, meaning that the pictures we take in the near infrared will look just as sharp as the Hubble pictures do. Hubble was optimized for around 0.5 micron. And so when you put them side by side, they'll be just as sharp, but they'll be telling you about different aspects of physics because you're looking at visible light in one instance and infrared light in another. So it's the same sharp detail detail, but looking at slightly different things. So it'll be fascinating.
Incredible. And just finally, as far as I understand it, the outbreak of coronavirus and the lockdown has put sort of further delays on JWST. I was just wondering how the lockdown is actually affecting the kind of preparation and launch of JWST, but also the JWST team at NASA in general. Are you all finding it easy enough to continue with the mission and amidst all the lockdown and the chaos that's ensuing?
Well, it's certainly an interesting time for everyone in the world, having to work from home in many cases. At Northrop Grumman in Southern California, at their Space Park facility where the hardware is right now, work is continuing on integration and tests, mindful of social distancing sort of considerations you have to take into account. So they are progressing there. Folks at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and I know at the European Space Agency and Canadian Space Agencies, a lot of them are working from home. And there's some work you can do from home, some software development, catching up on paperwork, the kind of things that tends to, you get behind that a little bit towards the excitement at the end of a mission. So work is continuing, not at the same pace as it would. Of course, we have to take the coronavirus effects into account. And once we come out of this at the other end, we'll evaluate our schedule and see how things look. But it's important to remember that work still is progressing right now.
Well, that's good to hear. But yeah, Eric, thanks very much for speaking to me today. And I just want to say I hope that we manage to get out of lockdown soon and you can get back to building this amazing telescope. And we look forward to seeing the science results that come out of it.
We all are here. There's a lot of us have been working for many years on it, and you know, we're that close right now, so we're very excited.
That was Dr. Eric Smith, and you can find out more about Hubble and JWST by visiting our website at www.skynightmagazine.com.
Now for our stargazing tip for May. This month will be the last opportunity to see the planet Venus in the evening sky for some time, though it will still be visible in the mornings. The bright planet is easy to spot even during the day, making it the perfect observation to make as we head towards summer and the nights get shorter. For safety, you should only try to look at Venus for a telescope or binoculars after the sun has set. Venus will be most obvious throughout the first half of the month. On the 1st of May, the planet will be visible for 4 hours after the sun sets, but by the end of the month, it will only be up for around half an hour. One date put in your calendars, however, is the 22nd of May. On that day, Venus and Mercury will pass each other closely in the sky, an effect known as a conjunction.
So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about Hubble in our May issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also celebrate the Sky at Night's 800th episode by talking with four amateurs who have followed the show's passion for astronomy. We also find out more about the greatest comets of the last century and look forward to the best conjunctions of 2020. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, or Spotify.